From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The newly declassified Family Jewels document illegal CIA operations of the 60s and 70s. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear about covert, illegal, and misguided CIA operations from throughout the agency's 60-year history. We'll talk with Tim Weiner, author of A New History of the CIA. Brad Bird wrote and directed the new animated film Ratatouille after he made The Incredibles. We'll talk with Bird and with comic Patton Oswalt, who does the voice of the main character. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz tells us the story of Ruby Elsie, a singer who was chosen by George Gershwin to perform in his new opera Porgy and Bess. A collection of her rare recordings has just been released. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The illegal operations documented in the just declassified CIA files, known as the Family Jewels, are hardly the only illegal operations in the CIA's 60-year history. My guest, New York Times reporter Tim Weiner, has written A New History of the CIA, in which he chronicles many covert, illegal, and misguided operations. He describes his book, Legacy of Ashes, as the story of how the most powerful country in the history of Western civilization has failed to create a first-rate spy service. Weiner has been reading The Family Jewels and reported on them yesterday in the New York Times. The Family Jewels are a collection of CIA memos written in response to a 1973 order from then-CIA Director James Schlesinger. After learning about the CIA involvement in the Watergate break-in, Schlesinger ordered CIA employees to report on any activities the CIA had engaged in since 1959 that were outside of the authority defined by the agency's charter. These declassified papers document domestic wiretapping operations, failed assassination plots, and programs spying on anti-war groups and American journalists. Weiner says the biggest revelation for him in The Family Jewels is how much resistance there was within the CIA to carrying out orders to spy on Americans.
By 72, 73, 74, the last years of Richard Nixon, the officers who were commanded to spy on Americans, and specifically to spy on the anti-war movement, everyone in the spectrum from Another Mother for Peace to the Black Panthers, they began to rebel. They didn't want to do that. And they didn't want to, maybe the problem was they didn't want to grow long hair and beards and, you know, go tracking leftists around the world, because it wasn't their job. That isn't their job. Their job is to collect foreign intelligence abroad, not to spy on Americans.
Is there a memo within the Family Jewels that you consider to be gold, you know, something really special for people like you who have studied the CIA history?
Yeah. There's a couple of pages from one of the most mysterious people in the history of the CIA, James J. Angleton, who was, among many other things, the chief of the counterintelligence staff, the spy catcher, for 20 years, from 1954 to 1974. Angleton wrote a report on himself, really, in response to this order from the Director of Central Intelligence to report any violations of the CIA's charter. The charter of the CIA, which was written in 1947, is exceedingly vague, but it's clear on one point. You don't spy on Americans. Your job is overseas. One of the things that Angleton had done through his 20 years in power was to help set up secret police abroad. In many countries, the CIA and other American agencies like USAID, the Agency for International Development, would create, in some cases, but train, arm, equip the police and military and internal security forces of third world countries all over the world. That would serve two purposes: to fight communism in Ecuador or the Philippines or South Korea or Bolivia, And also, these secret police units would collect intelligence for the CIA. Angleton had dropped a dime on himself by reporting that there might be a spot of bother here. There might be a flap because we brought a bunch of these foreign secret police into Florida to be trained by the bomb squad of the Dade County Police in Miami. That, to me, was a moment in time that I was unaware of. It was news to me.
What was the point of bringing them to Miami to be trained by the bomb squad there?
Well, among the many things that the secret police of foreign countries created by CIA and other U.S. government officers, among the things they did was counterterrorism to defuse a bomb. On the other hand, some of these secret police forces were themselves instruments of terror, and they made bombs. So you could read that either way.
You know, I think most of Americans are aware now that, you know, the CIA helped arm the Mujahideen, the Islamic fighters, against the Soviets who had invaded Afghanistan. What the CIA didn't realize was that those Islamic warriors would eventually turn against us. What surprised me in your book is that this kind of thing of, like, arming Islamic warriors goes back to the Eisenhower era. You write that Eisenhower wanted to promote the idea of an Islamic jihad against godless communism. He said we should do everything possible to stress the holy war aspect. So what kind of program did Eisenhower authorize the CIA to conduct?
The agency saw every Muslim political leader who wouldn't pledge allegiance to the United States of America as, quote, a target legally authorized by statute for CIA political action. And those are the words of Archie Roosevelt, who was chief of station in Turkey and the cousin of Kim Roosevelt, who was the czar of the Near East at CIA. So how do you do that? Well, you can give them money, and most of the powerful men in the Islamic world who were allied with the United States in the 50s and 60s and 70s took the CIA's cash. Or you can give them guns, and we did that. So they delivered American guns and American money to King Saud of Saudi Arabia and King Hussein of Jordan and the president of Lebanon and the president of Iraq. And these four gentlemen were supposed to be our defense against communism and Arab nationalism in the Middle East. And that's how things worked. In many ways, that's how it still works.
Now you write that President Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy actually unleashed covert actions with unprecedented intensity. That you say they launched 163 major covert operations in less than 3 years. What are some of the more major but lesser known covert operations that they authorized?
Well, they did it, as John Kennedy would say, with vigor. Let me give you a flavor of this by sort of reciting from the Kennedy tapes. Now, here's a couple of typical weeks in the summer of 1962 in the Kennedy White House. And we know this because John Kennedy taped these conversations in the Oval Office. And you can listen to them and read them online. And the Miller Center in Virginia has a number of them. We've just posted one today at the New York Times that is shocking. On Monday, the 30th of July, 1962, President Kennedy walks into the Oval Office and he switches on this brand new state-of-the-art taping system he's installed over the weekend. And the first conversation he ever recorded was a plot to overthrow the government of Brazil. So that was July 30th. August 8th, he meets with the director of Central Intelligence, John McCone, to talk about dropping hundreds of Chinese nationalist agents into Mao Zedong's communist China. And they joke about, ooh, what happens if they get shot down? Maybe a U-2 spy plane will get shot down. Ha-ha, next month Mao's forces shot down a U-2. Next day, August 9th, Richard Helms, later the director of Central Intelligence, goes to the White House to talk about overthrowing Haiti. August 10th, John McCone, Robert Kennedy, and Defense Secretary McNamara meet at the State Department. Now, this one isn't recorded on tape, but it's on paper, and they're talking about liquidating people in the Castro regime, namely Fidel Castro and his brother Raul. August 15th, McCone goes back to the White House. This is on tape. Let's overthrow the government of Guyana. Good idea. August 15th, same day. Let's figure out how to set up paramilitary forces in Vietnam, Laos, and Thailand through the CIA. And while we're at it, Iran, Pakistan, Bolivia, Colombia, the Dominican Republic, Ecuador, Guatemala, and Venezuela. Here's a document about that, the director of Central Intelligence tells the president. It's very highly classified, says John McCone, the CIA chief, because it tells all about the dirty tricks. Ha ha, they say. A marvelous collection, says McGeorge Bundy, the national security advisor. A marvelous collection or dictionary of your crimes. And they all laugh. So that's the summer before the Cuban Missile Crisis. Just 3 weeks.
What's the shocking document that you referred to that was posted on the New York Times website?
Oh, more shocking than what I just said? a shocking document we posted on the website of the New York Times is a taped conversation with a transcript of President Kennedy and Director of Central Intelligence John McCone and two intelligence advisors talking about bugging the national security reporter for the New York Times, Hanson Baldwin, which they did. Presidents and directors of Central Intelligence should not bug reporters for the New York Times, in my opinion. We can irritate them, but they can't wiretap us. Those are the rules.
My guest is New York Times reporter Tim Weiner. His new book about the history of the CIA is called Legacy of Ashes. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tim Weiner, and his new book is called Legacy of Ashes, The History of the CIA. Now you write that President Johnson was haunted by President Kennedy's covert operations.
And none more than the effort, successful effort, to overthrow the president of South Vietnam, President Diem, which happened 3 weeks before JFK was assassinated.
Why did that haunt LBJ?
He thought the murder of John Kennedy was divine retribution for the killing of Diem.
He didn't think that Diem supporters were directly responsible for it. He just thought this was divine retribution.
That's what he said. He said it more than once. Look, this was a horrible event. The United States was trying to defeat communism in Vietnam, and it decided that the president of South Vietnam was no damn good. And so it backed a coup to get rid of him. And the CIA did not kill Diem, but it had a very prominent officer in the camp of the generals and the colonels who overthrew the president of the country that we were trying to support. And, you know, 9 coups followed in succession, and we eventually had to send 500,000 troops in, and we lost, 50,000 dead, didn't we?
Did Kennedy authorize any covert operations to spy on Americans beyond the journalist who you mentioned?
The spying on Americans really got started in a big way under President Johnson and continued under President Nixon because LBJ was convinced as a matter of moral certainty that the anti-war movement in the United States was being controlled, manipulated, financed by the communists in Moscow and Beijing. Well, he was wrong about that. But he sicked the CIA on Americans to find proof of it. They couldn't find any, because there was none.
What did Helms have to say, who was then the head of the CIA, about being asked by his president to do something that Helms knew was illegal, because it goes against the CIA charter, to use the CIA to spy on Americans?
He reminded the president of the United States that the CIA was not supposed to spy on Americans. Richard Helms wrote in his memoir that he looked the president in the eye and said, you know, we're not supposed to do this. And he says that Johnson told him, I'm quite aware of that. I want you to pursue this matter, and I want you to track down the foreign communists who are in the anti-war movement. I'm certain that LBJ expressed himself more pithily than that.
So how extensive was the operation?
It wasn't that great a job, frankly, because there wasn't any evidence to find. But they tried. The CIA is an institution with a military ethos. If the President of the United States gives you an order, you salute smartly, go back to your office, and now say, God Almighty, what do I do now? The CIA reported to President Johnson that there isn't any evidence, Mr. President, that the anti-war movement is supported by foreign communists. And he sent them back, and he sent them back again, and he sent them back again. Presidents misused the CIA. Richard Helms, who was director for 7 years and was probably one of the better, if not the best, among the 19 directors of Central Intelligence, said that not one president, with the possible exception of George H.W. Bush, who after all ran the place for about a year, understood the first thing about the CIA or its secret operations. The history of the CIA is in large part a history of presidents who don't know the first thing about the CIA and who misuse it and abuse it and kick it. And the one who kicked it hardest was Richard Nixon.
You say that the collapse of the CIA as a secret intelligence service began on the day that Richard Helms left and James Schlesinger arrived. So what do you mean by that?
By the time Schlesinger left, later in 1973, the secrecy of the CIA was beginning to break down. Ronald Reagan tried to make the CIA secret again, but he made a huge mistake, which was to put his campaign manager in charge of the CIA. And that was the wily and devious William J. Casey. They tried to rebuild the CIA as a really secret, operating, covert arm of the United States government. And what did we get? They smuggled missiles to Iran, skimmed the money off to support the anti-communist guerrillas in Central America, and they got caught, which was a real black eye for the United States and for the CIA.
And that's Iran-Contra that you're talking about.
That I am.
What are some of the secret CIA operations that you fear we'll never really learn enough about because the documents were destroyed?
The mind control experiments conducted in the 1950s. There was a great fear during the Korean War that Communist China, North Korea, and the Soviets were taking captured American prisoners and turning them into zombies or robots. There's a movie about this called The Manchurian Candidate.
Great.
Which I recommend to your listeners. And the ethos of the time, and you had to have been there to understand it, was if they're doing it, we have to do it too. We have to fight fire with fire. So a number, how many, we'll never know, of programs were created with, you know, names like Project Artichoke, to figure out if you could control another human being's mind. The techniques range from hypnosis to heroin, from sensory deprivation to LSD. In one case, they took a prisoner in the federal narcotics penitentiary in Kentucky and fed him LSD for 77 consecutive days. They failed, obviously. I mean, it's very hard to control another human mind. And anyway, that wasn't their job. Their job was to know other humans' minds, to know what foreigners were thinking. And the only way to understand what another man thinks is to talk to him.
So the documents from that experiment were destroyed?
One of the things that Richard Helms did when he left office after Richard Nixon fired him in a very uncouth way at the end of 1972, was to clean up his files. And among the files that were cleaned up was the paper trail of the mind control experiments that he and the director of Central Intelligence, Alan Dulles, had personally approved 2 decades before in the early 1950s. Very few of those records survived.
The CIA has been so criticized lately, in part because of its reports that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction when it didn't, because of the secret prisons that it started, and its use of what many people describe as torture and its interrogation programs. Do you think that this fits in with the earlier history of the CIA, or do you think that these recent things are something new in the life of the CIA?
The CIA does what it does, with very few exceptions, because presidents order it to do those things. The president of the United States ordered the CIA to use, quote, special interrogation techniques, unquote. It's not that the CIA stuck up its hand and said, gee, maybe we should torture these prisoners, you know, and see if we can get some information. Presidents need to know what the CIA can and cannot do. This president, the evidence will be clearer 10, 20, 30 years from now, appears to have pushed the CIA beyond the limit of its capabilities. You know, if presidents want to change the world, send in the Marines. But if they want to know the world, that is why the CIA was created 60 years ago. And you cannot undertake covert action or war without intelligence. We, as a nation, are and will remain a superpower. What we do is project our power around the world. You cannot do that without intelligence. It gets you into terrible trouble.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us.
Terry, it's a pleasure.
Tim Weiner is the author of the new book, Legacy of Ashes, A History of the CIA. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from The Dial Press, publisher of The Archivist's Story by Travis Holland, a tale of suspicion and courage set in Moscow in 1939. From the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. And from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. In stores and online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Brad Bird, who made the animated film The Incredibles, talks about writing and directing the new animated film Ratatouille. And we hear from comedian Patton Oswalt, who does the voice of the main character. Then Lloyd Schwartz tells us about the singer Ruby Elzy, a soprano who caught the attention of George Gershwin.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are Brad Bird, the writer and director of the new animated film Ratatouille, and comedian Patton Oswalt, who does the voice of the main character, Remy. Remy is a rat whose exquisite sense of smell and taste make him yearn to be a chef. But a rat would never be accepted in a restaurant, and Remy's rat family is content to eat garbage, and they can't comprehend his passion for fine food. Ratatouille was slated to be written and directed by Jan Pinkava, but Bird was asked by Pixar to rewrite and direct it after he completed his animated film The Incredibles. Patton Oswalt co-starred in The King of Queens and organized the comedy tour The Comedians of Comedy. Here's a scene from Ratatouille with Oswalt as the rat Remy. Remy is talking to the ghost of the late celebrated chef and restaurant owner Gaston in the rafters of Gaston's old restaurant. They're looking down into the kitchen, where the kitchen porter has accidentally knocked the soup pot from the stove and is desperately trying to recreate the soup, throwing everything in sight into the pot. Gaston speaks first.
Now, who is that?
Oh, him? He's nobody.
Not nobody. He is part of the kitchen.
Yeah, he's a plongeur or something. He washes dishes or takes out the garbage. He doesn't cook.
But he could.
No.
How do you know? What do I always say? Anyone can cook.
Well, yeah, anyone can. That doesn't mean that anyone should.
Well, that is not stopping him. See?
What is he doing? No! No! No, this is terrible! He's ruining the soup! And nobody's noticing it! It's your restaurant! Do something!
What can I do? I am a figment of your imagination.
But he's ruining the soup! We gotta tell someone that he's not...
Did you study rats to help you figure out how Remy should look like and the other rats?
Well, he was designed. Jan had supervised the design with a bunch of talented artists. And so the character looked the way he looked. But they were kind of moving away from making them ratty. And one of the changes that I pushed for was making them more ratty. Everybody gets entertained by the notion, you know, a rat wants to become a gourmet chef. But right after they laugh, they kind of go, ugh. And they were kind of running away from the ugh by making the rats like little humans. All of them were on two legs and their tails had been shortened. And they were kind of, you know, acting like little humans. And I thought that was a mistake because I thought part of the charm of the story is really believing that they're rats. And then pushing past the ick factor and kind of seeing them as little beings, kind of like Hunchback of Notre Dame, where your first reaction is kind of, ugh, and then you kind of move past it. So we did study rats, and I had them re-rig the characters, which was a real time-consuming process because they had all been engineered to be on two legs, and I had them go kind of backwards. And when we put them on four legs, having been designed for two, all kinds of bulges happen, and it took quite a lot of work to get them to look good on four legs. But I think it gives the story an extra dimension.
Yeah,
because you see the rat choose to be on two legs. You know what I mean?
Right, and like his father and his brother and stuff, they're much more ratty than Remy is.
Yes. Well, and you can kind of gauge where Remy is emotionally, and the fact that he kind of has to pretend that he's on four legs when he's around his dad, you know, kind of because he doesn't want his, you know, he knows his dad's not going to approve of him walking around on two. So it just became something that was useful. It was, you know, sort of a window into his thinking.
Well, my guest is Brad Bird, and he wrote and directed the new animated film Ratatouille. And let's introduce Patton Oswalt, who is the voice of the main character, the rat named Remy, who has a brilliant taste for food and an intuitive knowledge of how to prepare it. So he's this, like, chef rat, little chef, as he's called in the movie. Patton, what was your reaction when you got the call saying, you're perfect to play a rat?
I think my reaction was more, I wasn't even concentrating on, oh, I'm going to be a rat, was that I had gotten a call from Pixar, and it was a Pixar movie being directed by Brad Bird, because I'm such a Pixar fan from back in the day. I mean, the short films, Luxo Jr. and Red's Dream, I would see them at animation festivals, and then I watched all the Pixar films.
You're a nerd.
I'm a huge Pixar nerd. So it's like asking, you know, a guy. It's like asking some weird Star Trek shut-in. Hey, would you like to play Kirk's son? Excuse me, what? All right. You know, you can't even. I couldn't even get my mind around that I was doing this. Luckily, it was a 2-year process of doing the voice, so I've been able to get my footing. At this point, you know, if it had been quicker, I would be the worst guy to promote this movie. Because I would just be me going, I can't believe I met Brad Bird and we talked and we had sandwiches. Okay, so this is weird. It would be so pathetic. He wouldn't want to talk to me right now.
Brad Bird, did you cast Patton Oswalt, and what made you think that his voice would be perfect for the main rat?
Well, actually, you know, he was talking. I heard of this comedy routine he did, Black Angus, about Black Angus, and it was he was so volatile but about food and so passionate and funny about it. You know, it just struck me that's the character. You know, he's so volatile, but in a good way. I mean, Patton has very strong opinions about anything, and he'll let you know. And when he loves something, he loves it, and when he hates something, he hates it. And that kind of extreme emotion is perfect for Remy, you know.
Patton, can you do a little bit of the Black Angus bit that Brad Bird heard you do?
Yes, it is very early in L.A. I'll try to do it with the same energy that he heard it. But basically, it's about how the commercials for the Black Angus restaurant, and Black Angus used to be a very friendly restaurant where I come in and have a steak and have a baked potato. It'll be a good time. And you go, that sounds fine. And then over the past few years that the commercials have turned into this like gauntlet of threatening food where it doesn't even look pleasant anymore. And there's this, it sounds like an initiation rite now. At Black Angus, we'll start you off with an appetizer platter featuring 5 jumbo deep fried gulp shrimp served with a side of our butter and cheese cream soup and 15 of our potato bacon bombs and a big bowl of pork cracklings with our cheese and
what the hell a couple
sauce.
Of corn dogs.
Yeah, exactly. And then you're like, oh, you know, we're each going to split that. No, you'll each get your own. Then we'll take you to our mile-long soup and salad bar with our He-Man 5 head of iceberg lettuce salad served in a canoe with 18 pounds of ranch dressing and what the heck, 4 cheeseburgers. Like, oh, man, you know what? I'll just get a little mixed green salad. Hey, I'll put on a dress and curtsy before I bring you a mixed green, buddy. Why are you yelling at me? And it just never ends.
Brad Bird, why did that make you think of the refined rat in your movie?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I think it was the passion that I was responding to more than anything else. The fact that he could get so wound up about the food, you know, because, you know, Patton also talked about how he just loves steak, you know, the weird thing is I didn't really grok that Patton was a foodie. That was just one
did
of
you
many
say
routines.
Grok?
On grok.
You just said,
yeah, that's
you
a Steve Jobs word,
and
by
you
the
said
way.
Grok.
It precedes.
Hey, that's a Steve Jobs word.
It precedes
and
Steve
I
Jobs.
I learned it from
that,
Steve Jobs.
Isn't that from like Vonnegut or something?
Is I
it?
Think it's
I don't
Heinlein.
Know. Steve
no,
used it.
Oh, it's Heinlein. Heinlein. Robert Heinlein.
Oh,
yeah.
I just nerded out again.
You out-nerded me.
No.
Yes.
It's Heinlein, not Vonnegut. Excuse me. Yes. No, you're wrong.
Isn't that Lovecraft?
Yeah. No, I actually heard that from Steve Jobs. So, yeah, okay, so Steve uses that word.
Okay, good.
So now it's been de-nerdified. It's now officially cool because Steve used it. Yes.
I didn't know that he was a foodie. We actually hired him, and he was working before I knew that he was. This is like a major thing for Patton. If he goes to any town, he scouts out what is the most happening restaurant in that town, and he will send you a menu. I mean, he will email you the menu from a great restaurant. And he's emailed me a few, and he'll like say, order this. I mean, he's a major foodie, and that's perfect. But we didn't know it when we hired him.
My guests are Brad Bird, the writer and director of Ratatouille, and Patton Oswalt, who does the voice of the main character. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Brad Bird, the writer and director of the new animated film Ratatouille, and comedian Patton Oswalt, who does the voice of the main character Remy, a rat who wants to be a chef. So, Patton, did you change your voice at all to play a rat?
No, they stressed to me. I went in thinking, because I do a lot of voiceovers, so I was like, okay, I got to think of a cool character. And Brad really stressed to me, we want your voice. It's the way you talk. It's the way you get wound up and passionate about stuff. They also stressed to me, it's the non-judgmental enthusiasm you have, where I'm never like going, oh, now is this cool to be into? Should I temper my enthusiasm for this? I sort of have that Asperger syndrome. I'm just going to be into this, and I kind of shut the rest of the world out. And that's sort of Remy's strength and predicament when you think about it.
He said Asperger.
Brad, how did you direct Patton?
A lot of animation directors get behind the glass, and the actor is kind of out there like in a fishbowl. But I always try to be in the room with them.
You were really in the room with me, man.
Oh, yeah, man. I'm just hovering. Yeah. Actually, there are beads of sweat dropping on his script. You know,
yeah.
You can. I kind of sit there and hang out in the room, and if we have trouble with an area, you know, if something was great, I mean, read fine on the page, but doesn't sound good coming out of someone's mouth, then I'll try to rewrite it on the spot, and you know, I'm there with them. I'm not. I don't want them to feel alone and kind of alienated, which the recording sessions can be that way if they're out in a room all alone, and then there's a wall of people behind the glass, and you can't hear them kind of, you know, talking to each other. I think that's an alienating thing, so I try to hang out with the actors. And so, you know, I just work with them. I try to tell them where it is in the movie and what the character's feeling, and sometimes if it's a physical effect, if they're doing something that's really physical, I'll try to get them kind of close to that. I mean, we dumped water on Patton. And the poor guy. I mean, he really did give his all for this movie.
Well, so, you also, like, he would grab my arm and yank me. Like, he would go, just read your line normally, and I would start to read it, and then he would push me from behind, and it would change the reading. He was like a very friendly peck and paw, now that I think about it. It's very nice. And also, the thing about people don't realize about Brad Bird is, you're a really good voiceover actor. So every scene I was in, the other lines, he could just kind of summon the other characters. So, you know, I didn't work with any of the actors, but I certainly worked with their characters. So if I was getting intimidated by my dad, that was happening in the studio. He would be reading my dad's lines, really, and it would change my performance. It was great.
Now, you know, the movie kind of is really enamored of wonderful food, but it also satirizes very pretentious food and pretentious people who are foodies. So, in your tours of the finest restaurants as research for the movie, if you could each share one of the most pretentious food things that you experienced.
Pretentious food things for 20. I can't think of a specific thing that, I mean, we were at the top one in Paris at the moment, you know, that 2 years ago that we went. And they had a guy for each person at the table. You know, five of them would descend on your table at once, like a D-Day landing, and they'd go, and you'd get everything at once. You know what I mean? All the dishes would be landing at the same time, hot. And, you know, the amount of coordination that would take to do that is just staggering. And they're that good, which is why they get 3 Michelin stars.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as goofy as it is, we wanted to have that kind of feeling in the movie because, you know, the movie is nuts. I mean, it's a crazy idea. But if you can surround it with believable, you know, observed truths, you can kind of that kind of buoys up the movie and makes the fantasy more believable.
Patton, what's one of the most pretentious foodie things that you witnessed?
Well, I remember Brad Bird and his wife took me and my wife to the French Laundry in Yountville as part of research.
Thomas Keller is a consultant on the film,
Keller,
too.
Oh, yeah, he designs a very crucial dish in the movie. But they had, it was a 17-course meal, except that my wife and I would get course A, Brad and his wife got course B, and you would taste and then pass around. So it was a 34-course tasting. And I remember near the end of the meal, it was almost like, is this a thing they do in Guantanamo? Because I'm literally about to, I'll tell you.
Yeah, they get
I'll
your guard my, down.
Yeah, just yeah. Stop. I can't take anymore. So it got to this point where my wife, they brought out pork loin three ways, and it was, of course, delicious. But my wife, like, took a little bite of each one, and she said, I physically, unless a waiter comes and stamps down the food, like, puts his foot down my throat, and makes me, I can't eat any more food. And the waiter gave this look like, is there a reason you're not eating this right
yes,
now?
That's
and
she's what like, they do.
She goes,
that's what
I
they
love
do.
It, but I'm just so full. And he looked like he was about to go back in the kitchen and get stabbed, like they were going to kill him. He looked so upset. Yes. Why aren't you eating this? We're like, because you've given us 25 courses. There was a salt course. Oh, here, okay, listen to this.
Five different kinds of salt.
There was a salt course, five different kinds of salt. This was found at a fossil dig in Montana. It dates from the Jurassic period. I'm not kidding.
It's not a black
fossil salt. And we like, is Ashton Kutcher going to come out and like yell at us?
And I think you'll be amused by its presumption, you know?
You'll be, and how about, remember the butter course that comes from a single cow?
Yes.
That they own at a
and they know the name of the cow. They know the name of the cow. This came
they know
from
what it's fed.
Bossy. In Vermont. And we're one of
so
only
crazy.
Two places on Earth that can get Bossy. The thing is that we're laughing about it, but at the same time, you can taste a difference.
Oh, it's
ridiculous. And that's the most ridiculous thing, is that the five different kinds of salt actually do taste different.
Uh-huh.
And they actually bring different aspects out in the food. I mean, if you pay attention, on one hand, you're laughing about it because it's obsessive. You know, somebody is super into this, and Keller is as into this as Patton is to comedy, and I am to filmmaking. But the truth of the matter is, if you're paying attention, it actually is a different experience. And the butter was different. Some of it was sweeter, and some of it was creamier. And they were all it actually was an experience. But just next time, just a little mercy, that's all.
Well, Brad Bird, Patton Oswalt, thank you both so much for talking with us.
It's been really fun. I love your show, Terry.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me back. Thanks, Terry.
Oh, yeah, it's really been a pleasure to talk with you both.
Yeah.
And congratulations on the new film.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Brad Bird wrote and directed the new animated film Ratatouille. Patton Oswalt does the voice of the main character, Remy. Oswalt has a new comedy CD that will be released next month. Coming up, a soprano who caught the attention of George Gershwin. Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new CD of her rare recordings. This is Fresh Air. Even among lovers of great singing, Ruby Elzy is not a household name. But classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says she was not only a wonderful singer, but a figure of historic importance. A new biography of her and a collection of her rare recordings now document her considerable achievement.
Yeah.
The story of Ruby Elzy is a powerful example of how talent can overcome seemingly insurmountable odds. One of four children, she was born, her biographer David Weaver tells us, in abject poverty in a small town in Mississippi. Her father abandoned the family when Ruby was five, but she could sing. A visiting professor, astounded by her voice, helped her get into college. Then she got a fellowship to Juilliard. In 1933, she appeared opposite Paul Robeson in the movie version of Eugene O'Neill's The Emperor Jones. When George Gershwin heard her sing, he cast her in the major role of Serena in his new opera, Porgy and Bess. She made her Broadway debut in this role in 1935 at the age of 27 and sang the part more than 800 times on Broadway and on tour. Her future success was all but guaranteed. She had an extraordinary soprano voice, both pure and searing. She was good-looking, and she could act. Serena is the woman whose husband is murdered by the villain Crown, and Elzy's rendition of My Man's Gone Now electrified the audience. She never made a commercial recording of it, but three of her performances have survived, two of them from radio broadcasts. Before Porgy opened, Gershwin took five of the leading players into a recording studio to conduct parts of the opera with an orchestra. On this rehearsal recording made on August 19, 1935, here's Gershwin himself introducing and conducting Ruby Elzy in My Man's Gone Now.
Now we have a song by Miss Ruby Elzy in the second act, scene one, called My Man Is Gone Now. I'm sorry, it's in scene two, act one.
All three of Elzy's surviving performances of My Man's Gone Now are on a remarkable new disc compiled by David Weaver that includes all 20 of her known recordings, the majority of which are spirituals. In 1941, Ruby Elzy appeared in another film, Birth of the Blues, with Bing Crosby and Mary Martin. She had already made her recital debut at New York's Town Hall and been invited by Eleanor Roosevelt to sing at the White House. Her repertoire also included art songs and arias, the most ambitious of which is probably Elsa's Dream from Wagner's opera Lohengrin. This stunning performance is from 1937. In the 1930s and 40s, it would have been impossible for an African-American singer, however extraordinary, to sing Wagner's lily-white heroine in a fully staged opera production. But in 1943, Elsie was preparing the role of Verdi's Ethiopian princess, Aida, when she had to have surgery. It was supposed to be a relatively minor operation, but she died in a Detroit hospital at the age of 35. Since her death, she's been largely overlooked, except for Gershwin mavens. But thanks to her biographer turned record producer, David Weaver, no one who hears this recording could possibly forget her.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix and teaches history at the University of Massachusetts, Boston. He reviewed the new CD, Ruby Elsie in Song. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, Jonathan Menhivar, and Joan Tui Westman. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, supporting health insurance coverage for all America's children, on the web at covertheuninsured.org. From the Dial Press, publisher of The Manny, a novel about life on the wealthiest acre of Manhattan's Upper East Side, by Holly Peterson. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
It's outrageous to line your pockets off the misery of the poor, outrageous to cry.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Simon. He was just awarded the first annual Library of Congress Gershwin Prize for Popular Song. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Complain, but I'm tired. 900 sit-ups a day. I'm painting my hair the color of mud, mud, oh.